Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report. With Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 25th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Edgar Villanueva, Vice President of Programs and Advocacy at the Schott Foundation for Public Education and author of Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. Also on the program today, a brief excerpt of me whining about the time I've spent with my kids on vacation. It's now we've been in Florida now. We came down Sunday, and we left way too early. I don't know why. I thought the idea was to leave at 8:30 in the morning. It doesn't make sense. Because I got to get the kids to the airport. I got to get everybody up at 6:30. We got to leave at 6:30. Why would I do that? Particularly the night after Passover. So I had a Seder at the house. Now, of course, this is all speculation on my part. I mean, this is the plan that I have 3 to 4 days out. We supposedly had a Seder Saturday night. Then I tried to get the kids to go to bed early. They wouldn't, of course. Just it's all, again, speculation. And I couldn't fall asleep, so I got about 2 hours of sleep. We flew down to Florida, and I'm trying to wrangle the kids. Now I'm thinking we should have gone to Disney, and I didn't. I thought maybe we could just get by with just, like, the pool. And that didn't work out. And Mila, of course, is, like, telling me that this was a huge mistake. All her friends are having fun, and I've got her down by the pool hanging out with a six-year-old. And, then, of course, Saul's going, "You're the worst dad ever because you won't let me watch another episode of some weird Netflix show that he wants to watch." And the kids are just yelling and screaming at me, and we've got about another 24 hours before we get back on the plane tomorrow. And my whole thinking was that I could just drink by the pool and just, you know, sort of be numb to it all. That fell by the wayside.
Why Florida in the first place?
I don't know what I was thinking. I mean, I scheduled it way out in advance, like when it was in February. Like, I scheduled this in January. And I'm like, it's freezing. I can't wait to. And now it's like it's beautiful here in New York. And I was like, the first thing I was going to do was go to a pool. I mean, not go to a pool, go on a cruise. And I was like, if I could find a 4-day cruise, I would go on it. I've never been on a cruise, but my understanding is they take the kids and then they're gone. And then they just show up again at dinner and that's it. In the morning, they take the kids and then. Because it's impossible for me to find something they both want to do. There were caverns that we visited in upstate New York, Howe Caverns. They both like that, but that's just an hour. And then I've got another 5 or 6 days to kill. So the idea was I'll take them on a cruise. And then there was no 4-day cruises that left before Passover. And we need to celebrate Passover. There was only a 7-day cruise. And I was like, I am not going on a boat for 7 days. I'm just not going to do that. Not the first time out. So then I thought, like, well, what else can I do? And then I was like, it was a sale on the Club Med, the one in Florida. that's not even on the ocean. It's on a river. And I was like, well, Saul will like, you know, looking for alligators. So this could have been the smartest move of my life, or it could have been the dumbest move. So we don't know.
At least it's interesting.
At least it could be interesting. We're all in one room, though. The three of us sleeping in one room. I'm going to need to recover. Folks, I may not be coming back on Monday. I'm going to need to recover. But hopefully I've had time to check out some of the Skillshares I want to watch. One of today's sponsors is Skillshare. And anyone who goes to skl.sh/majorityreport2 is going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design to video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, meditation, everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You'll have no problem finding courses that's going to be useful for you in both your personal and professional life. Whether you want to sharpen your skills with something that you already love doing, or you just want to pick up something that you never thought that you would be looking at in your entire life, Skillshare has it all. Head to skl.sh/majorityreport, and you can check out stuff. I'm looking at, what have I been watching while I'm there? I'm trying to guess. I have my list of stuff that I want to watch. I've told people about it. I'm going to probably check out the Photoshop. Is that what it's called? Photoshop. Oh, sometimes you say that and it doesn't sound right. Photoshop. I'm going to do, I know people are going to be like, what? What are you doing? But I'm going to look at all the like the entrepreneurial ones. If there's one like tip I can get to make the job easier, and I'm probably going to be doing like workflow videos too, just to see if we can, you know, juice things up here a little bit. And then maybe I'll do some more cooking stuff, like the cutting, like knife work. It's worthwhile, I'm telling you. You can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majorityreport2. Just think of everything you're going to have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. Again, that's skl.sh/majorityreport2, the number 2. And I put a link underneath this video if you're watching on YouTube, and if you are listening, it's in the podcast description. Also, the Majority Report today is being supported in part by Simple Habit. Simple Habit is a mobile app that provides massive and diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations. And my audience can try Simple Habit totally free for an entire week when you go to simplehabit.com/majority. There is a ton of anecdotal and data supporting the values of meditation. And Simple Habit has over 2,000 guided meditations, 2,000 of them, specially designed for different parts of your day and just about anything you might be dealing with in life. They got guided meditations for anxiety, if you're feeling depressed, if you're having trouble falling asleep, meditations for when you want to deal with your procrastination, or just for mindfulness, when you have something important going on at work. They have meditations designed for parents who are sitting with their kids just wondering, what was I thinking? What was I thinking coming to Florida? They have them for all sorts of times of the day, lunch break, when you've gotten home from work, when you're going to bed, when you wake up.
Before you're booking a vacation.
Before you're booking a vacation. Different people, I needed to clear my head, and I was in the wrong space. Different people try, to accomplish different things with meditation. Simple Habit is able to cater to just about anyone, regardless of your goals when it comes to meditation or how much past experience you've had with meditation. The variety of guided meditations on Simple Habit is what sets it apart, and it's why Simple Habit won the 2018 Google Play Award for Best Wellbeing App. It's available iOS, Android, web browser, all possible ways, and the Majority Report audience can try it for free by going to simplehabit.com/majority. If you're watching on YouTube, if you're listening to the podcast, it's in the description. Check out the link. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Edgar Villanova is going to talk to us about some of the problems with philanthropy. We've touched on this topic in the past. And one of the problems that Villanova has, Nueva, I should say, has encountered in his years in this area is the narrowness of perspective that inevitably comes from people who have the kind of money that can create a foundation and the types of folks who work there. And there are, he's got a really interesting take on this. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Edgar Villanueva. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the chair of the board of directors of Native Americans in Philanthropy, vice president of the Schott Foundation for Public Education, and author of Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance, Edgar Villanueva. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
All right. So let's start with first off, I guess, you know, I want to get to sort of some of the basic statistics of philanthropy. But what do you perceive the purpose of philanthropy to be? Because, I mean, ultimately, I want to talk, but you know, I want to go through the premise of your book. But the arguments about even maintaining the maybe not so much the concept of philanthropy, but the mechanisms that we use to support philanthropy in this country. But what is the purpose from your perspective?
At a root, fundamental sort of purpose behind philanthropy for me is that philanthropy is the love of mankind, which is the word literally translated. Informally, philanthropy is something that exists in our communities as a way of being in relationship, you know, a way of reciprocity, of ensuring that all of us are well taken care of and have a sense of belonging. As that is institutionalized, and in this country we have a very unique system, a tax code that has created this sort of industrial complex around philanthropy. The purpose of that, I think, is, you know, kind of spans the gamut of investing in charitable causes that improve, you know, the quality of life for all of us. In many cases, philanthropy has served as a sort of a laboratory to test out new ideas and considerations that may be adopted and taken to scale by the government, so forth and so on.
All right. And so give us some statistics, though, because, I mean, you discuss in many respects philanthropy is failing in a myriad of ways. And some of the statistics in terms of who gets the money and where that money goes and how much of that money is actually given out to or, you know, redistributed in some fashion is sort of surprising.
It is very surprising. So, you know, on the surface, it appears that all of this work is very charitable, but what happens with philanthropy is actually most of the money is not even going out in the community. So we have a tax system that allows for wealth to start a foundation. The resources put into that foundation are tax exempt. In the country, we have about $800 billion, billion with a B, sitting in the coffers of foundations. So this is $800 billion that was not taxed. You know, of course, that money would have gone into public education, into the safety net and services that we so need. So of the $800 billion, the only requirement for private foundations is that they pay out 5% of their corpus over a three-year rolling average. So on average across the country, about 5 to 7%, only 5 to 7% of that $800 billion is being actually invested in the community. So when we look at that, about 5%, where is that money going? Who is receiving that money? There's a major discrepancy there when it comes to race. Only about 7 to 8% of those resources are going into communities of color. And so this is sort of one of the injustices that I bring up in the book, because when you think about the history that people of color and indigenous folks have played in helping to generate wealth and accumulate wealth in this country that leads to the creation of these foundations, we as communities are barely benefiting from these charities being started. So very small crumbs from the table are finding their way into communities of color. The second thing that's really important for folks to understand, so what we just described is the 5 to 7% that actually leaves. The majority of foundational resources, about 95% of those resources are actually invested in Wall Street, and for the most part with a values-neutral lens to how that money is invested. And so what happens there is that many of the investments of foundations, these nonprofit foundations, are actually invested in extractive and harmful industries that are harming communities and the land. So like private prisons, oil, and so forth and so on.
So you're giving with one hand, taking away from the other, to the extent that you're doing any of the giving, I guess, at that point. Well, so let's talk about the implication of the title. I mean, I think it's there implied, right? We're decolonizing wealth, but let's talk about the structures of colonization that exist within. Well, within the context of society, I guess more broadly, but then we'll narrow to the world of philanthropy.
Sure. So, you know, one thing that I lay out in this book is a primer on colonization, because it's something that's really important for folks to understand, especially those of us who are working to make change in communities. We have to understand how we got to be where we are today. A big part of that is our history of colonization, which was something that we sort of romanticize. When we learn about colonization in our history in schools, you know, growing up as children, we think of colonizers as heroes, and there's a complete narrative around that that is actually false. Colonization was a terrible, terrible, atrocious thing, and it's something that actually continues to happen around the world and is still happening a little more subtly in communities in the U.S. The mantra of colonization is to divide and conquer, to command and control, and above all, exploit. And so this process of colonization that is so closely tied to the accumulation of wealth in our economy was founded on a system that actually exploited other people. And so when we look at current situations around poverty, we have this significant race wealth gap in this country. That's all related to a history that brought us to this point. And so when we hear messages like, well, if certain folks would just work harder, or pull yourself up by the bootstraps, and we're agnostic to the history of trauma that has resulted in so much poverty in communities, then we're really kind of missing an opportunity to think of ways to invest that is a lot more respectful to that history.
And it's not just a question of trauma. I mean, obviously, when we talk about trauma, we're talking about slavery, we're talking about genocide in some respects. But from a structural standpoint as well, right? I mean, the wealth is built, was built either on land or on the, taken from native peoples. And I guess the industry of taking that land was also a generator of wealth. But of course, the entire industry of cotton, which really became the economic engine of this country, was fundamentally a function of having really, really inexpensive labor, specifically slaves. And then it's both a structural dynamic that has been was reinforced through the years by government policy, whether it had to do with housing or whatnot, in terms of being building wealth and getting income, as well as the sort of the emotional trauma that is can be carried generationally easily, it seems.
Absolutely, Sam. You're exactly right. You know, it is this literal accumulation of wealth through stolen land and genocide and slavery. And those dynamics, the dynamics of colonization, which allowed such atrocities to happen, it's just so rooted to this mindset of separation and exploiting other folks. And, you know, I have this term that I call the colonizer virus, because often in this country, we've kind of swept our history under the carpet. We don't want to think about it. You know, we want to, you know, we kind of learn about slavery in schools, but we as a country have not truly grappled and come to terms with our history, like many other places have begun a process. And so those dynamics of colonization, which are about separating and dividing and exploiting, it's like a virus that still permeates in our culture and in our institutions. You see it in our policies and systems. Our public education, for example, reflects the colonizer virus. So does our food system and agriculture. You look at our environmental policy. You look at foreign policy.
Edgar,
you see that happening.
Will you be specific about, I mean, just explain to us how we see that what you call the colonizer virus, and I think to some extent also it includes your notion of a separation worldview. How do we see that in the context of, let's say, education or within our food policy?
Yeah, so when you look at our education system, for example, we know that public education is funded in a way, in a very archaic way in this country that's based on property taxes. And so obviously richer neighborhoods where they pay higher taxes benefit from those resources and have better schools than poorer neighborhoods, which have fewer resources and where more children of color tend to go. And we, you know, there are innovative things happening around the country to try to address that disparity, but we haven't fundamentally, you know, passed the law at the national level or even the state level where we actually believe that an access to a high-quality public education is a right in this country and fully funded education in a way that is equitable across all demographics. And so that that mindset of, you know, that's just the way it is. It's always been this way. This is a good school. This is a bad school. This is a good neighborhood. This is a bad neighborhood. The mindset of separation and division is a direct result of our colonization. And we've gotten so accustomed to things just being that way. And what allows the folks who have wealth and the folks that have power to make these changes, what allows folks to be complicit in that often is this separated mindset. We do not interact or have proximity often to those communities that are poor, and we don't have a relationship with them, so we don't feel connected to them. This is a completely like Western idea of individualism and separation that's very counterculture to an indigenous idea of us all being inherently connected.
That separation world, and let me just, you know, I mean, put a fine point on this. I mean, we can literally track the not only just the accumulation of wealth through the years, but even as late as, you know, the early 50s, late 40s, when we see government policy in terms of backing home mortgages. I mean, you can see the ripples of that. You know, that's not that long ago, 60 years ago, 70 years ago. You see the ripples of what that means in terms of home ownership and not just personal wealth, but wealth within the context of neighborhoods. And that directly implicates the quality of education that's available for people there. And so you've got two different forces that are working on a continuous structure of oppression in many respects, and so in some ways that separation worldview is, I mean, other people might call that a practice of white supremacy.
Right. Absolutely.
And all right. So so we have these dynamics that are going on, and so talk about the literal structures of colonization that you have found in the context of philanthropy and, I guess, philanthropical institutions.
So, you know, when you follow the trail of money and how capital is moving through the world, it's very easy to see the same pattern of colonization. Those same dynamics are at play. Specifically to philanthropy, the foundations that we were talking about sitting on $800 billion in capital, when you take a look at how that money was accumulated, which we've kind of touched on through a historical perspective, but when you also look at who is actually sitting around making the decisions around how that money is invested, who gets to allocate, manage, and spend it, and who receives that money, then you see there's a major race problem going on there. By far, the trustees of these organizations are white men. The CEO and leadership of these foundations happen to are also white. And then when you look at who is receiving the funds, we touched on that earlier. You know, only 7 to 8% of organizations and communities of color are receiving the funds. And so this is why I often refer to the wealth that's inside of foundations as wealth that was twice stolen. You know, once from a historical perspective and now from a perspective of escaping taxation.
Right.
And going into the coffers of a foundation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is one of the key elements, at least in the moment, as it were, that this money is supposedly, it is supposedly important enough to escape taxation, rather, like the where this money is going is supposedly significant enough and important enough that it should not go towards, should not be democratically discharged, essentially, right? And it should not be to the general good, that theoretically the places that this is going are important enough to be sort of outside of that system. And you write that some of the structures, you can see some of the structures of colonization in things like the architecture of the foundations. You can see it in the formats of the grant work, as well as the inclusion of people of color and how people of color within the context of these foundations sort of have internalized some of this, the sort of implicit and explicit messaging. Talk about that dynamic, that sort of almost the nuts and bolts of the workings of these foundations.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when you think about white supremacy, foundations, you know, white supremacy shows up in the culture of organizations in different ways. And within the world of foundations, if you can kind of think of it as a bubble of which almost like magnifies that. It's a lot of wealth and power and privilege in a small space. And, you know, I share my story in the book as a person of color. I'm Native American. I'm from the South, from a very poor family. It's a really interesting journey to find yourself within that bubble and then, you know, trying to navigate that space. It can be very painful. What I talk about in the book, I think a lot of folks may not understand, but what upholds these cultures and ideas of white supremacy, it's a two-legged stool. One is old-fashioned white supremacy and dominance and oppression that is the one that we talk about most often, where the ideas of, you know, white is best, or who we think of as being smarter or more capable, happen to be white, and we're fed that through all types of messages. But on the other side of that equation, often it can happen that people of color or people who have been oppressed by this system can internalize that behavior and that thinking. So even though we are, black and brown people, we can actually leave and behave in a way that is equally as harmful if we are not decolonizing our thinking and ways of existing in the world. And so the message is that all of us, whether black or white or indigenous or other, we all have to do work to, when I say decolonize, I literally mean just to shift our thinking from a mainstream way of thinking, a white dominant way of thinking, to a way that is more inclusive and equitable and a little bit more connected with each other as human beings.
One of the things you talk about is this is sort of the concept of like apologies and truth and reconciliation. And I often forget is that Canada, you know, people think of truth and reconciliation, they contemplate South Africa, but Canada had its own sort of truth and reconciliation process. There is a paradigm for the USA that is not too far afield, right, from Canada. I mean,
right,
it's there for us, right? What's the importance of something like that?
I think it's super important. You know, you're right. South Africa had a process. Canada had a decade of truth and reconciliation. Germany has had a process. And so what this process was literally a decade of, you know, simplifying this a little bit, but actually just listening and telling stories. So Canada made the space for First Nations people there to tell their stories, to educate, to share the pain that they have gone through as recent as a generation ago when, you know, children were forced into boarding schools and taken away from their families. And so, you know, this is so critical. And because in order to heal and to move forward as a nation, one, we have to know that this happened. Young folks in schools now are so far removed from the history and are not taught, you know, an appropriate history of what happened in this country. And then we kind of, as a community, don't like to think about these things. We want to sweep it under the carpet. And I think what happens when we do that, it begins to fester. And then out of that comes what we're seeing happening in this country now, all types of ugliness and divisiveness and hatred, because we just have not come to terms with our history in order to properly heal and move forward.
You provide seven steps of healing that are driven from the native traditions. Give us a broad overview of those steps and what, how they might be implemented, where, you know, what they would, you would hope they would achieve.
Sure. So the steps are kind of steps that you might think of in a process of restorative justice or truth and reconciliation. So it really starts with holding up a giant mirror and taking a deep look into the mirror, either at a personal level or organization or as a nation, to look back and understand the pain that has been caused to folks in this country, and to reopen those wounds and to grieve them and to apologize for them. And this is not just for white people to do or for people of color. This is for all of us, because we have all been traumatized by this history in different ways, and we need to come to terms with that. And it's not something that I think that we can opt out of. And then moving through the process, we, of course, would apologize when you truly understand the history and what has happened as recent as, you know, yesterday, really. You're going to be moved to a place to apologize for what has happened and wanting to make amends. And this leads to other steps in the process of listening and really deeply connecting with people, sharing our whole selves with each other, and getting to a place where we at least, even if we don't agree with each other, we can understand and respect each other. And from there, there's going to be a variety of things that happen that reflect that we are on a healing journey. We're going to have better representation in places of decision making. And I bring this to the context of money and philanthropy, like, you know, having representation there and looking at where, who's calling the shots, where resources are going. And all of that leads us to investing resources in a different way that lead to healing and repairing. I think this is very pertinent to the moment, because we're having a conversation once again in this country around reparations. You know, the Democratic candidates have been discussing this, and many have said that reparations would be a part of their campaign promises. I think I'm really interested and excited that we're having that conversation. However, I think that we've jumped ahead in wanting to quickly put a Band-Aid on something and to move some resources and hoping that that will repair and kind of this festering of racism that we have happening in this country. I personally think it's a bit premature. I think that there's work to be done before we can actually get to a place of reparations. If we don't understand the history or know it, if we don't feel bad about it and grieve and apologize for it, I think it's going to be hard to make the case to move tons of money to actually help repair the harm that's been done.
So, all right. So, and I think that makes sense. And I would imagine like some measure of reparations agenda would hopefully come with like a sort of a mandatory, you're going to need to figure out why we did this type of element. But let's move to that question that I had mentioned earlier. Was, I mean, what you're outlining here is a reformation of the way that essentially philanthropic institutions do their business, as it were. Why that, as opposed to say, you know what, we're no longer going to favor, because of the structure of who got that money and how they got that money, and binds us to how that money is redistributed, that it really does not rise to the level of being tax-free. I mean, you know, that's a crass way of saying it, but it really does not rise to the level of being outside of our system. It is not religion. It is, you know, where we have a constitutional, you know, we have a constitutional reason to, you know, not tax it. It is just something that we supposedly think will help society at large. But in fact, in many ways, it's just continuing the inequities that from our society, to, you know, to be fair, to no fault of their own. They're just, you know, this is we've been programmed in a certain way. And rather than try and deprogram this, we can basically just not encourage it in some way, which we're doing when we make it tax free. Like, why not just say, you know what, philanthropy, it's nice, you can do it. But if you're really interested in doing this, you can do it with money that's been taxed.
I am all in favor of looking at changing legislation or enforcing legislation that really reexamines this whole system, because I think most of it is actually delusional. I think it's ridiculous that folks are given a tax break to put money aside that actually does not ever have to leave the door to the community, that's actually invested in Wall Street and in private industries. So it just really makes absolutely no sense. We've also painted this picture about philanthropy and charity that is just not real. You know, no wealthy person in this country has ever started a foundation or given away money and become less rich the following year. You know, we're celebrating Jeff Bezos, for example. You see the headlines. He was the largest, gave away more money than anyone last year, the biggest philanthropist. However, he's richer next year as a result of that. And so the truth is folks are getting major tax breaks for this philanthropy. And, you know, and I could debate whether or not I feel okay about that. I might be okay with that if I knew that all of those resources were actually being invested in the community in a way that is fair and equitable. But we know that is actually not the case. And so all of that needs to be reexamined.
Right. I mean, I guess the question is, you know, is that even possible? I mean, maybe, right? Like, you could, I could see perhaps, you know, over a certain amount of money, if you wanted to give more beyond your taxes on some level, that will give you a tax break on some percentage of your wealth if you put it into a fund where we have a more democratic process of distributing it. But we sort of have that system already, and it's called taxes. Right? I mean, like
exactly.
I mean, we could redesign the system in some fashion, but we have that system already. It's called taxes. And the only way at the end of the day, it seems to me, to have a democratic version. And I'm not saying there shouldn't be philanthropy. If you want to give money to, you know, Lincoln Center, by all means, give money to Lincoln Center. It's just that why should you get to decide how our taxpayers, how our tax dollars are spent, and you get named after it? Like, you know, I don't get the Sam Cedar right. Day that they pick up garbage. That's not named after me. You know, that seems to be the fundamental problem, right?
No, you're absolutely right. And it's, you know, folks are getting a tax break. They're getting to become wealthier as a result of that. And they're getting to be lifted up in our communities as heroic, charitable humanitarians along the way. And so absolutely, I think, you know, I think that the system should be changed, that if folks just pay more taxes, we probably wouldn't need philanthropy as we have it now. And I also think there are incremental changes that can be made. So, for example, there's no type of restrictions on what their board looks like. A family can start a foundation and their board governance could be just all family members that fund whatever causes they care about or whatever organizations they care about. It's not unusual for organizations that receive money from the federal government to have restrictions or requirements on what their board should look like. And so one easy thing that could be passed by the government is that any foundation that started that is has public charity status should be required to have a board that reflects the community, that is not all family members or all corporations, corporate members, but it is a diverse board that, 51% of it reflecting people who are, benefiting or served by that organization. Happens all the time for everyone else, but we have escaped any type of accountability within this field because, it's a field that is wrought with all types of elitism and privileges and wealth.
Edgar Villanueva, the book is Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. We will put a link at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
To get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick. Choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years while I shifted in and out of. I don't know how much.